Many Madison chefs use the city's proximity to get great fresh ingredients to make their mark on the capital's resource or restaurant scene. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and our next guest is Lindsay Christian. She is a fine arts and food writer for the Capital Times. She reports on dining trends, writes restaurant reviews, and hosts the food podcast, The Corner Table. Her book, Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People, was published this year. Do you prefer restaurants that use locally sourced food? Do you have a favorite chef? Well, we'd like you to be part of the conversation. Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Lindsay, thank you so much for coming in a little early today.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. It was such an interesting read. I've been wanting to do this book for a while, and so we had the opportunity to do it now. How did you get involved in writing about food in the first place? Because I read that that wasn't necessarily your first love, was it?
No. I went to here to UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. I got a master's in theater, and I wanted to be a theater critic. I took a lot of classes in the building, so...
Oh, you knew that, you know Vilas well, then.
Yeah. It's a maze.
Yeah, it is a maze. Not amazing. Maze.
A literal maze, yes. So I started at the Cap Times in 2008 as an arts writer, covering theater, dance, opera. I reviewed the symphony then, and it was wonderful. I've always loved cooking, but I was not the food writer. We had a food writer. And then as things went in journalism over the past, 15 years or so, you probably noticed it's been shrinking.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. And so newsrooms were getting smaller. And so when our food writer left, that was something I already had an interest in. I had already been doing, some fill-in things for her before she went. And so it was just kind of a natural add-on to my beat. And the more I did it, the more I discovered how much I loved it.
Yeah. Were you familiar with the restaurant part of it at all before you started doing that?
A little bit, but not much. I really primarily come to it through cooking.
Okay.
I love to cook. I am an avid and frequent home cook. And particularly during the past couple of years of the pandemic,
sure. Yes.
I've really leaned into that hard. I have a pretty substantial cookbook collection, and my husband would, pull a cookbook off the rack, and I would cook out of it for 2 weeks just to focus on that one cookbook.
What a great idea.
And it just kept it interesting when, we couldn't go to a lot of restaurants. Mm-hmm. But yeah, doing this work as a journalist is really my introduction to the restaurant scene.
Just so you know, I'm thinking of starting a support group for those of us who collect too many recipe books, because I am with you.
I don't think too many. I don't believe in too many, I should say.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have a lot of bookshelves.
I do.
Good for you. So were there some things that surprised you about the restaurant business?
Yeah. I mean, I think especially as I went into reporting the book, one of the things I wanted to write about was failure.
Yeah, good topic.
Because I think when you see that a restaurant is closing, a lot of people will express surprise or dismay. But then you think about, when's the last time I went to the Avenue?
Sure.
Maybe it's been a minute,
yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there are reasons for these things. And I think one of the things that surprised me was thinking about how restaurants have natural lives. And not all of them are designed to be around forever. Not even Smokies here in Madison was around for 50 some years, right? Mm-hmm. So, but restaurants do have natural lives, and thinking about that as being, a restaurant being a little bit of a time capsule or like a representative of its moment in some way, that was new to me.
I love that. That is a really good way of putting that, and especially for restaurants who have been around for a while, that sometimes it's just time to go on to something else. So
yeah.
I like it. So how did this book come about?
So the book came about because Raphael Kadushin, who was the head of UW Press, wanted to do a series of profiles. He had chosen four chefs that he was interested in. And he had this idea that the chefs themselves would write it, basically, would write their own little profiles.
Okay.
And then he had a photographer who, who had signed on to the project. And chefs are chefs, for the most part,
that's right? Yes.
And they're restaurateurs, and they're busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a chef, I'm a writer. So after a little while of that, of trying to sort of get that off the ground, Raphael realized he needed to bring a writer in. So I moderated a panel about food writing with Melissa Clark.
Okay.
And with some other really wonderful folks in the spring of 2017. And that's when Raphael contacted me and said, would you like to do this project?
Yes. And you jumped at it, I'm sure.
I
No, you thought about it.
So I talked with a friend of mine, James Norton, who runs The Heavy Table in Minneapolis, and he's done several books.
Okay.
And he's done some of them with academic presses. And when you do a book like this, you don't do it for money, right?
Right.
And you have to do it understanding that it's going to be a lot of time and a lot of work, and it has to be something you really care about. Because for the most part, like, you're not, it's not going to be like, oh, I've got it made now.
Yes.
So that was something I really wanted to talk with him about. Like, what did you wish you'd known before you negotiated your contracts, and how much time did this actually take you? And how much time am I looking at taking off work to do this?
Oh,
right.
That's true. Cause you have a full-time job.
I do have a full-time day job. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I took some time to think about it and decided ultimately that it was a project I would be interested in.
Well, and I can tell by reading it that you really enjoyed interviewing the chefs and talking to the farmers and the producers and whatnot. What was the hardest part of actually selecting those chefs that you, I mean, you only have, what, 9 in here? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so there's so many of them. How did you narrow it down?
Well, I wanted to look at chefs who I thought were being innovative and making change. Any restaurant that sort of had the same menu all the time, year round, and didn't change it too much. I looked at chefs who were with restaurants who were pushing into what I think of as the new upper Midwestern cuisine. Like, what does it look like now? And it looks like, in some cases, indigenous foods. It looks like, sort of global ingredients. It looks like using ingredients from this food shed in central Wisconsin in ways that maybe we haven't seen before. We have really rich histories in sort of our Germanic culture, but also there are these, as I said, huge indigenous populations. And there are chefs like Tori Miller who are using local peppers to make Korean-influenced food, you know. So I wanted to look at chefs who were pushing ahead, trying something new. Underground Food Collective was one that I looked into in part because of the cooperative model that they were using, which seemed to me really interesting and a place for creativity and growth. So I wanted it to look ahead. I wanted the book to be pushing ahead. So I looked for chefs who were doing that.
That helps narrow things down a
little
bit.
It does, yeah.
Yeah. Now let's just look a little bit at the history of restaurants in Madison. You talk about that a little bit in your introduction. What was it like, before Odessa Piper came in and she came in with her restaurant. What was it like around here?
So that's a good question. So I should clarify, I was not living during the 70s, but I did do some research.
Think so. No.
And there is a wonderful book by John Michael Rasmus and Nicole Frum called, I think it's called A Madison Food, A History of Capital Cuisine. I think that's right. And they published that in 2015, I believe. And that's one of the things that I used to get a sense of that history. So we had some steakhouses, you know, we had some pizzerias, and taverns were really big. Taverns still are really big.
Of course, it is Wisconsin,
you know?
Yes.
So, but it was interesting because there were some food trends, like the capital was not anything like what the capital is now. And I wanted to be careful when I was looking into that history of being honest about it, but not romanticizing it too much. But at the same time, looking at okay, what are we taking from that history that we have? I don't think that the connection with local farms really came in until the farmers market got rolling in the later 70s. I don't think you saw quite that connection between ingredients and restaurants. But it was happening right around the same time as Chez Panisse and Alice Waters in San Francisco.
Which surprised me.
Yeah.
That's so early. So it was like, not that they were really talking to each other, but that, oh, this is a great idea.
Yeah.
So it was kind of organic.
We do have a lot of collective history and cooperative history. And by that I mean like co-ops, right? Like
mm-hmm.
things like Ovens of Brittany was incredibly
right.
influential.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things, I think, we hear about more on the coast, but they were definitely happening here.
And we tend to forget that, you know, we always think, oh, it's not cool if it's from the Midwest, but it's so untrue. We just have to open our eyes a little bit, right?
Yeah. My dream is to have something like the Southern Foodways Alliance, but for like the cuisine of the Upper Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that exists a little bit, but not remotely in the way that like SFA has it. So.
Sure, sure. And talk a little bit about SFA.
So I follow Southern Foodways Alliance a mm-hmm. little bit, but you know, I live here. But they have a wonderful magazine. They
okay.
have major events, and including like a big symposium every year.
Wow.
Where they have chefs come through, and they have entrepreneurs, and they have farmers, people doing really innovative things. And so I feel like the more conversations that we're having around what innovation looks like in the farm fields as well as in restaurants and how those things are connected, I'm really interested to see where those things are happening. Coming up here in Madison on August 21st, there's an event called Farm to Flavor.
Oh, neat. What's that about?
It's going to be very cool. So that's going to be over at Garver Feed Mill. And basically what it is it's farmers who are growing, like they work with researchers at the UW. They're like, we're going to grow all these different varieties of cucumber, and then we're going to do taste tests with chefs and see like, okay, yes, this one, I like this one better than this one, but this one grows like this, and this one needs, you know, this much irrigation, and it's this disease resistant, and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so. I think we've talked to a couple of those growers
it's
here
so cool,
on the
right?
show. Yeah, it really is a great collaboration, and I know both sides love it. So
many kinds of beets.
It's amazing. We're talking with Lindsay Christian. She is the fine arts and food writer for the Capital Times, and her book is called Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms and People. What questions do you have about restaurants using local producers? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. So let's get back to your book a little bit. Let's talk about Odessa Piper, because
sure.
she kind of started things, and lots of people don't, if you're not from the Madison area, you probably have never heard of her before, but tell us, who is she?
Odessa Piper. She's sort of the matriarch
right.
of this restaurant scene that we have. She founded L'Etoile, I want to say 1976.
Has it been that long?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And she was the first chef from Madison to win a James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest, I think in 2001. And she is amazing. So she came out of Ovens of Brittany. She wanted to do a restaurant using the produce from local farms. She had that little space on the Capitol Square that was, you know, up above on Pinckney Street.
Teeny tiny.
Not accessible at all,
no,
you know.
No.
But she had this space, and you know, she'll talk a little bit more openly about it now, that she never really wanted to do fine dining. But if you're going to pay farmers what their produce and their meat is worth,
mm-hmm.
you have to charge a certain amount. That's still true.
Yes, it is.
And so she kind of had to do fine dining. And it's interesting, Tori Miller, who has taken over the restaurant, he took over with his sister, who has since left, in, I think, 2011 or 12 officially. So he's talked about how all the young chefs who worked with her wanted to impress her, that she wanted to bring out the best in everyone. And she talked about food, she still does, in a very evocative, almost romantic way. But she has these deep relationships with farmers. And I've walked around farmers markets with Odessa a few times in more recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And it truly, like, she knows everyone. She asks, you know, tons of questions to everybody about how they're doing and how they've been. And she doesn't live in Madison anymore. She lives out east.
Oh, my goodness.
So she's coming back and visiting, and she's remembering all of these relationships that she cultivated for decades.
Mm-hmm. So what did she start? How did other entrepreneurs and chefs follow what she did?
So Tammy Lex was one of the first to follow here in Madison, and she opened Harvest. And then the Old Fashioned next to that. Tammy worked for Odessa as a chef and a forager for a couple of years, I believe. But one of the things that was interesting to me about Odessa's legacy is when she was starting L'Etoile and really wanting to use these, you know, produce from these wonderful farmers in the farmers market that had just started, she realized they needed more than what L'Etoile could provide. L'Etoile was and still is a relatively small restaurant. It's bigger now. But she knew she couldn't buy enough to sustain them, to support them. So she started helping them connect with chefs in Chicago. So Rick Bayless is buying from Snug Haven Farms or whatever, things like that, where it's she's making those connections to the larger market so that they can have a more sustainable business model, which I thought was very innovative.
And, very much so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And thoughtful, because she's thinking about their livelihoods. You know, she wants to use their produce, right?
Of course, yes.
So it's a little selfish,
too. Wants them to stay around, obviously. Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was really interesting. And I think when you start to see more, you know, more sort of farm to table restaurants, you know, restaurants that are sourcing very deliberately, that there was sort of a wave of that. And then by the time I was writing the book, there was a wave of what I would call greenwashing, where restaurants are saying that they're getting their things locally. And are they?
Yeah.
You know, you buy from a farm once and you put them up on your board and then you don't buy anything from.
Oh, that's sneaky.
It is.
And not fair.
Right. But when you look at, like, how do we decide whether a restaurant is farm to table or not? Like, how much transparency do you actually want if you're just there to have a burger?
Right. Right.
You don't want to hear the whole story of the cow's life. Maybe you do. I don't know. But then there's also the question of, if you look and say, okay, well, how somewhere like Salvatore's Tomato Pies, that does a ton of local sourcing and works with lots of local farms, they do more in the summer and fall, obviously, than they do in the winter. But they still have to serve pizza in the winter.
Right, right.
Right? And they can't just top it with preserved things because we don't want that in 2022.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a quandary about what's available, especially in our area. Yeah, those lovely restaurants in California have a little bit more choices to do, but we just have to use our imagination a little bit more, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I remember Tammy talking about, at the Old Fashioned, they had this idea that they were going to make, I think it was like local handmade ketchup. She's just going to do ketchup. She's going to make ketchup. And she's like, I realized pretty quickly that that would be the only thing we were doing. We would only have time to make ketchup because they went through so much of it.
Of course, of course. Yeah, there's all those things to consider before you start doing these new ideas. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that Madison attracted all these innovative chefs over time? Was it Odessa, or what was it, the community?
I think it's proximity to farms. I think that's one. And having the farmers market here is a big one. I think the pace of life is a little different here than it is in Chicago. So you have a lot of chefs. I'm going to be doing an event this Thursday with Matt Schiebly from Merchant here in Madison. And I was talking with him the other day, and he said that he did 10 years in Chicago. A lot of chefs do that. They go and they work in Chicago for a certain amount of time. And the competition is a bit different, and the pace is different. The life is, it's a different life. Which is not to say it is an easy thing to run your own restaurant here in Madison, but it's a little more possible to, say, have a family.
Right,
you know,
right.
And have mm-hmm. it be a little bit more sustainable. But we still have the population here that wants to try different kinds of things, or is, you know, or is either willing or able to pay a little bit more for something that's locally sourced. And so there, that combination, I think, works.
Yeah, is that part because of the university and about the capital being here?
I think it's the university. I think it's the capital. I think it's a bit of both. I think you have people around Madison who maybe have traveled and are interested in having that, you know, Vietnamese dish again. But I think it's also, I mean, we're a city. Milwaukee has a little bit of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think having the farmers market here and the size of that farmers market and the impact of that cannot be overstated.
Definitely. You know, involving like the food producer was kind of a pretty new idea at the time. What are the benefits of using locally sourced ingredients besides the obvious, you know, they taste better?
So there are a lot of benefits. There are also challenges.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the benefits is that you're gonna be able to work, for example, with a farmer if you want to have a certain kind of pepper. There in the book, there's a story about Johnny Hunter at Underground working with a farmer to grow a specific kind of pepper that he loved from these seed trials. And they had the farmer grow them. They had a contract, and then he bought all of them. Right?
Yeah.
You're taking a risk, though, along with that farmer, because a lot of times you'll have chefs who talk about, you know, well, I bought X amount of onions. The seeds aren't in the ground yet. So hopefully it works out.
Right.
You're taking risks together.
Sure.
But it means that you are more connected to that local food shed, not only to that farmer, but also just to this place where we live, right? And it's a deeper connection. I think a lot of restaurants are used to working in a very specific way with their ingredients and their produce. You check and see if you've got enough lettuce, and if you don't, you place an order with the provider, with the, you know, with Sysco or whoever, and then they bring it to you the next day or two.
Right.
Next day, golden produce, next day. And so things like that, if you're working with farms, it doesn't always work that, like that. It actually usually doesn't. You have to place your order further in advance. You have to make more assumptions and guesses. You're taking more of a financial risk, but you're also trying to estimate how much you're going to use, how much you might not have. So I think working with local farms, some of the relationships that I observed of like, oh, you know, we had a bad season for such and such, and Tammy helped us process all of them because we had to turn them into something so that we could use them. That kind of connection, it's less, I think, quantifiable, and it's a little bit more, it's a little bit more about community and emotional connection and mutual support.
Mm-hmm. Which is making everybody a little happier in what they're doing too. So, now you did most of your research before the pandemic hit.
All of it. Yeah.
Okay.
The book came out like,
Cause it was like January, right? That it came out. Is that right? Okay. So how did this affect the whole, the book? How did the pandemic affect what you were doing?
So this is a kind of boring answer, but it didn't really.
Okay.
So the book was pretty much finished by January of 2020.
Okay.
I had a final draft of it in, we had all the photos in, it was in design. And then, I met with the editor of UW Press at the time, and he said, you know, we're going to hold it a year.
Ah, okay.
Because this fall, all anyone will be talking about is the election.
True, true.
It was sort of true. Mm-hmm. We were also talking a lot about the pandemic.
Yeah.
But this was January 2020.
Okay.
So we, you know.
Yeah, there was a 3 month there before we actually got hit by it. Yeah.
So he's like, you know, we're gonna hang on to this for a year. So what ended up happening is it let me have a little bit more time for editing. Which there are pros and cons to
that.
Yes,
there are.
Because I think as any writer will tell you, or creative person of any kind, it's hard to declare something done.
It is, yes.
But it was nice to be able to sort of write my introduction in a way that sort of made clear, like, this was a time that has ended a bit. When I was first writing, it was really hard for me to figure out when is now. Like, can I write about a restaurant like Estrion in the present tense? Estrion was open up until a few months ago, right? So just knowing, like, how to put certain things in present tense or past tense. And as soon as the pandemic happened, I was like, okay, no, all of this is in past tense.
Right. Like, it's very true.
Yeah.
And really, even as we're talking now, things are changing. So,
sure, yeah.
I mean, that's the restaurant business, number one. So what has been the effect of the pandemic on Madison restaurants?
It varies restaurant by restaurant.
Uh-huh.
There is not one answer to that. I would say that some restaurants that got restaurant recovery funds did a little bit better than restaurants that didn't. That was pretty tough on a lot of restaurants, especially because there were these things set in place where, you know, certain folks were supposed to have a window to apply first, who have historically have not received the kind of funding. And then there was a court order and a reversal of that. And so a lot of people that were approved for funding never got it.
Ugh.
And there was resentment around who got it and who didn't. There was resentment around who stayed open and who didn't, you know, who decided to close, who had the capital to just stay closed, versus folks who either decided or had to reopen for, you know, delivery and carry out and things
right.
like that,
mm-hmm.
which we well know was a risk for those employees.
Definitely.
Right? We all love takeout and all that stuff, but that's putting your employees at risk as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really complicated time, I think, for restaurants, and a lot of people went through a lot. I think we're still going to see some hangover from like the impact of the financial choices that a lot of restaurants had to make during the pandemic. I think we're going to see another sort of wave of closures at the end of the fall, which makes me sad, but I think that's what we're going to see. I think also it's been tough for restaurants to get employees back because I think a lot of them felt disposable during the pandemic and they weren't treated as well as maybe they should have been. And sometimes those jobs weren't great before the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of restaurants are trying really visibly to make the jobs better, right? To pay a little bit more, to offer benefits to those employees who want them. And to just treat employees as part of a team versus sort of an expendable,
Now some of the chefs I noted when I was reading it, they really do. Mm-hmm. They really care about the people that are helping them be successful. Did you find that be the case with these chefs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody like Francesca Hong, when I was interviewing her and Matt Morris, they both run Morris Ramen here in Madison. Francesca Hong is now a state representative representing Madison. And part of her platform is very closely connected with labor and how a community can advocate for itself and how communities can be resilient when they work together. But she was doing a lot of that groundwork when she was at Morris with the way that, she still is, but with the way that, she treated employees, the way that that restaurant treated their employees, and they wanted to have open conversations with them, even when they were hard and the stuff they didn't want to hear.
Yeah,
because anyone who's ever worked in a restaurant or a coffee shop or a bar, we all have our complaints.
Yes, we do. It's not easy.
No.
It's not easy at all. And a lot of times the employees are not treated very well.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic has actually made that worse. So
yeah.
I've done some research and some writing about how basically customer behavior has gotten worse to staff. So you're not getting paid great, and then people come in and yell at you about whether or not to wear a mask, and you're just sort of like, oh gosh, why do I do this?
Yeah, it's kind of a shame. Now we haven't really talked exactly about what the book is. So in the minute and a half we have before news break, tell us about the book. What do readers find in it when they pick it up?
So Madison Chefs is a series of profiles. I think, as you said, there are 9 chefs in there. And it is basically, each chapter is the story of how that chef or that couple of chefs started their restaurant, where they came from, why they decided to do what they did. I talked to their mentors. I talked to sometimes their parents.
Yeah.
I talked to the farms they work with, and I talked to some of their staff and employees. And I tried to sort of give a picture of how did this person end up where they are? How did this restaurant end up the way that it is? And how is it changing what upper Midwestern food could be?
And there's recipes.
Oh my gosh, there's 28 recipes. Yes, there are.
Was it hard for those chefs to give you those recipes?
Yes, it was.
I figured it would be. I was very impressed that you got so many.
That's a lot of work. Thank you for recognizing that.
Absolutely, because we know what the chefs are like.
Mm-hmm.
Even our home chefs, we want to keep our recipes to ourselves. So we're talking with Lindsay Christians. She is a fine arts and food writer for the Capital Times. Her book is called Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms and People. And it's a great book to read even if you don't live in the Madison area, because it's really great information about these chefs. So anyone who's interested in the food business, this would be wonderful for you. And we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. Our guest is Lindsay Christians. She is the fine arts and food writer for the Capital Times, and she reports on dining trends. She writes restaurant reviews and hosts the food podcast, The Corner Table. Her book is called Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms and People, and it was published earlier this year. Are you a fan of restaurants that use locally sourced ingredients? Do you have a favorite? Give us a call. Let us know. We want to hear about it. What questions do you have about successful restaurants? Our number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Lindsay, before we went to the news break, we were talking about the chefs unwillingly, maybe, or reluctantly giving you recipes. And you actually shared one with us that people can access by going to WPR.org/Larry, looking for this show. And underneath, you'll see related links, and it'll be for hickory glazed carrots. Just briefly tell us a little bit about what that recipe is about and why you suggested it.
For sure. So I suggested it for a couple of reasons. One of them is that I'm getting gorgeous carrots right now from Vitruvian Farms, which is where we have a CSA. But also because it's a recipe in Tori Miller's chapter. you know, it was from L'Etoile, mm-hmm. but that is a recipe by Itaru Nagano, who has a restaurant here in Madison now called Fairchild,
okay.
with Andrew Krager. And it is one of my favorite new restaurants to open in the past. I guess they opened technically in 2020.
Okay.
Like a week or two before the pandemic.
Oh, nice timing.
Yes. But it's a recipe that is accessible, so it doesn't have too terribly many ingredients. It does call for hickory nuts, and I'm not sure if it's maple syrup or there's another syrup in there, but you can swap in maple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one with like a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of nuttiness. There's a blue cheese in there. Obviously, you can substitute for anything you like if you're not a blue cheese person. But I made almost every recipe in the book. I did not make 100% of them, which I can talk about in a second.
Uh-huh.
But I tested them all, and that was one of my faves. And there were several others that I liked quite a lot, but like if you're not, you know, up for making an apple strudel yet, like in the middle of summer, like the carrots are perfect because they're gorgeous right now. It's a simple recipe, and it highlights a chef who has a beautiful new restaurant, so.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So what was the story you wanted to tell about testing those recipes?
Oh, so I did not. So Patrick DiPullo was very insistent that he wanted the burrata in the book. Burrata is mozzarella with a cream center, basically.
Yum.
So it's this gorgeous ball of fresh mozzarella. And when you basically break it open, like almost like with a soft boiled egg.
Okay.
It just sort of oozes out the center and it's creamy and lovely. It's delicious. Don't get me wrong. But Patrick and his restaurants, they get mozzarella curd and they make their own burrata. In order to make burrata.
This does not sound easy.
No. So you need like very warm water because you're forming the balls in this super hot water.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh yeah, I use like 7 layers of gloves. And I'm like, oh my God. And so I checked around in Madison and I was like, okay, well, you know, if I'm going to try this, how am I going to do it? So I called Fribonis and Fribonis told me that they could get me 5 pounds of mozzarella curd. And I live with my husband and that's it.
That's a lot of curd.
And I just thought, oh Lord, I've been saying, as I'm doing publicity for the book, I've been saying, you know, I tested these recipes. I know that they work. If you do the burrata, you're on your own.
That's
like,
right. Okay.
This is what he's going to tell you. And it's not so much that like the chefs don't want to give you their recipes. They're not secretive about mm-hmm. them for the most part. It's just that chefs generally don't work from recipes in the same way that we do.
Yeah.
So somebody like Dan Fox at Heritage Tavern has a team of people making the chutney and the slaw and the sauces and those kinds of things. He's not doing it alone like most of us are.
Right.
So, you know, I'm making the, it was spetzel for one of them, which is halushki in the culture that I come from. I'm Slovak.
Okay.
But spetzel, very similar, where you're sort of shredding it over boiling water and you're mm-hmm. waiting for them to float. I will totally make that. That was one part of a recipe that had like 4 other parts.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and some of us like to read cookbooks like a book. So,
I do, yeah.
You
I
know,
definitely do.
We don't necessarily going to make this recipe, but it's really interesting to see how it was made and what's in it. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
I told myself early on, I was like, these recipes are just going to be examples of like the things that the chefs make, right, at the mm-hmm. restaurants. And then when I actually got into it, I was like, no, they all have to work. They have to work.
Oh, for sure.
So that's why I tested them and I actually used volunteer testers as well. And I'm starting work on a new cookbook project, which is exciting.
Ah.
But all that I learned on like how to test a recipe, how to make sure it works for a home cook, how to sort of, you know, offer both weights and volume measures for folks because not everybody has a scale.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things. I'm taking all of that and sort of using it in the new project.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you let us know because I really want to not only read the book, but we'd love to talk to you about it too.
Oh, for sure.
Well, let's get back to the one you're working with right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did you have to go to get all your information? I mean, it's about Madison Chefs, but you went all over the state, didn't you?
I did. Mm-hmm. It was really great, actually. That was the most fun part.
Yeah.
So one of the first trips that I took was out to Kate's family farm near Spring Green, and we got to walk around with the cows. And Francesco Mangiano, who is the chef at Osteria Papavero, has worked with Dick Cates for many years, and they have a good relationship. And we were able to sort of wander around the fields, and we got to ride in the truck. It was a blast. Francesco brought his kiddos with him, and then we had this lovely lunch out on the farm, but we were out and about. We went to Mount Horeb to Garden de Bee, which is a beautiful farm out there. They grow a lot of microgreens, but they grow a lot of different things as well. We went to Vitruvian in the middle of the winter. Vitruvian is in McFarland. And Patrick DePula will get, you know, microgreens and mushrooms from them year round. So it was really fun to go out to some of these farms, but also I walked around the farmer's market with Francesca Hong, and she had her baby stroller that she used for her little boy. And we just filled it up with like bok choy and onions and all kinds of things. And it's fun to sort of go to some of these farms with the chefs, or to hear, you know, Tammy Lax talk about foraging for mushrooms.
I was so surprised that she just goes out there with her little knife and
Yeah, and her family has property up north. There's a cabin up there. I think when I talked to her about it, like, I don't know if this has changed since then, but like, it didn't have running water or electricity. Like, it's just out in the middle of their land.
Yeah, we have a family cabin like that. It's fun for a while.
Yeah, but she learned how to, you know, draw things like berries and mushrooms and all kinds of lovely edible things out of that that landscape, that food shed there. And she takes that inspiration, that influence, and she brings it to her restaurant in Madison. So I think I hear a lot about this divide that we might have, either sort of culturally, politically, whatever else, between the urban and rural areas in Wisconsin. And I don't think it's that bright a line, really. Like, I think there are so many people with so many connections to these, you know, other places in Wisconsin that are not Madison,
right?
That they grew up there. They learned the cuisine that they love there.
Yeah, because a lot of the chefs are from Wisconsin.
Yes,
not necessarily Madison.
Yeah, and a lot of them talk about how having a restaurant has helped them claim that, you know, culinary identity, like the things that they loved when they were growing up, like finding ways of bringing those into a restaurant setting, or I don't like the word elevating, really, but kind of elevating or turning them into something that feels authentic to them.
Right. And I thought it was something, you know, we're talking about this, but it was kind of amazing to me that the chefs that you included, the food is all pretty much accessible. Mm-hmm. Not all of it, you know, that weepy mozzarella. But, you know, you're talking about pizza.
Yeah.
And pizza in Madison, or in one case, Sun Prairie. So talk a little bit about those pizza places and how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the pizzerias is Grandpa's Pizzeria. It's owned by Gil Altschul. And that is one where they do tavern style pizza. So it's cut into squares.
Okay. I didn't realize that was the word for square cut. Okay. Tavern style.
Tavern style.
Who knew?
And it's cut into squares, and the crust is a bit thinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dough recipe that Gil originally got from his grandfather, although I would hesitate to say that it's identical to that because things evolve and change.
Sure.
But it's a thinner crust. It's cut into squares. It's a very specific sort of style of pizza. And I love that he said, and I've heard this before too, but the pizza you grew up eating is going to be the right pizza in your mind.
Oh, that's so true. So true.
Right? Wherever you were, like I come from near Detroit, and we had, you know, deeper dish pizzas, right? Detroit style.
Uh-huh.
And then at Salvatore's, it's more of like what I would think of as a hand tossed. Like if you're doing like Pizza Hut levels of like crust, right?
Yeah, if you want to, but yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it's like a little bit thicker.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. And part of the reason it's so good is that he lets that dough rise for a long time. I think it's overnight. It's like 12 to 18 hours or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's a slow rise, and there's no sugar in the dough. Mm-hmm. He's also using some whole wheat flour or whole grain flour that is sourced locally. And how they source the flour and some of those things, I'm always hesitant to say that because things change based on availability, time of year, like how much it costs for that, you know. So when I say that something is locally sourced, I want to be clear.
Yes.
I can't talk about tonight at the restaurant, but
in general.
Yes. So they are trying to find, you know, these ingredients that make it taste very much of a place, you know, or unique to where they are. So the thing about pizzas, it's fascinating because Patrick DePoula will talk about how you can put things on a pizza and people will try it that they
would not try. It's so true.
Yeah. So agretti, which is this like kind of slightly bitter herb, green. He's put rabbit on pizza before. People are like, rabbit? Mm. But the minute you call it like coneglio or whatever, yeah, like then people will,
exotic.
Will try it. Yeah. So things like that where it's the pizza as the plate, you know, of like, oh, well, it's pizza. Like, I'll try it on there. You know, something a little bit different, or a little bit weird. Not weird, but
unusual.
Unusual, yeah. Or something they didn't expect that's not your typical, you know, tavern style pizza topping.
Mm-hmm, so. Definitely. So let's just talk about one of the chefs here. Tori Miller, probably most well known, got some national attention. Talk about him. Tell us what he does and what's his actual vision for his company.
Oh, so Tori sort of came to Madison thinking it was going to be a temporary stop. And he ended up putting down roots here, I think, for a couple of reasons. He has family in the state. He has made a family in the state. He's got little boys with his wife, Christine, who's a pastry chef. And he is one who I think is kind of always pushing. Like, he's always pushing forward, not to be better necessarily than somebody else, but to be better than he was yesterday. So I think he's just kind of endlessly curious, but he also is working all the time. And a lot of the chefs were like this. I remember I was talking to Dan Fox about some earlier chef jobs that he had. He's like, well, I was only working 50 hours a week at Madison Club, so I need another job. And I was like, oh my God.
Only 50 hours a
week. So he took another job making burritos or whatever. Anyway, so it's Tori's a bit like that. So like during the pandemic, they're changing how they're doing things. For example, at L'Etoile, where they were doing these sort of lovely family style dinners that you could pick up.
Mm-hmm.
But then he opened Miller Family Meat and Three and was doing like a Meat and Three style Southern sort of concept. Sujo, his restaurant over on East Washington Avenue, was inspired by his Korean heritage. He's a Korean adoptee, was raised in Racine. But Sujo itself had influences from all different parts of Asia, I would say, right? There were Vietnamese dishes and Thai style dishes and Lao dishes and things like that. They were all sort of filtered through this central Wisconsin lens. You'll see some of the things that he loved doing at Sujo now on the menu at Gray's.
Okay.
And you'll see some of that influence on the menu at L'Etoile as well. The thing about somewhere like L'Etoile is you're expecting to see technique on the plate, whereas at Gray's, it can be a little bit more casual.
Right.
But the ingredients are the same.
Yeah. And that's kind of nice because it probably attracts different clientele too. So then they can be exposed to all the different things too.
Well, right. And I can afford L'Etoile once every other year or something.
Yeah, right.
You know? But Gray's is a little bit more of a, you know,
doable.
Weekly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will also say, like, Another way that I think that Tori really pushes forward, Gray's has a service charge now. So as restaurants are thinking about ways that they can better compensate their staff so that they can provide them things like benefits and things like that, if you start to see prices just on the menu items go up, people will often balk at that. But a service charge, you can sort of explain, here's why this is here.
Yeah.
Because our costs for these things have gone up and we have to figure some stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're trying some different things in terms of taking care of their people as well. I'm watching, always watching that as well as what's on the plate.
Yeah, and that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
We do have a caller online, Jim in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim. What's your question for Lindsay?
Thanks, Jill. Lindsay, in your travels, I heard you say you have a Slavic heritage. I too have come from my ethnicity is from that area. Grew up with Bohemian foods. You ever come across anything on restaurant menus across the state?
Oh my goodness.
Great question.
I wish I could say yes more enthusiastically than I can. So yeah, my family is Slovak. We're from Northwest Ohio. And like the Slovak food that I get to have is generally at my mom's house.
Always the best.
Right? But like that's where I learned to make yaternitsi and pierogi. And I've been thinking lately that I want to learn how to make more of these dishes from that I grew up with, like halushki. And chicken paprikash and that kind of thing, because you don't see it on menus. Like finding a pierogi on a menu, oh my goodness, I think there's one at Mint Mark here in Madison. And you'll occasionally see it. Like I'll see some things that are kind of similar, you know, if there's a supper club with a German slant.
Mm-hmm.
But not a ton. And I wish there was more. I feel like that's a huge gap. Honestly, in our restaurant scene, somebody
opened
an Eastern European
right
restaurant.
Yeah, there we go. I have a little bohemian in me too, Jim, so appreciate that.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so that's a great idea. So we still have gaps in the state.
We do. Mm-hmm. We have gaps in the state. We have gaps in the city. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely something I'd like to see more of.
Yeah, for sure. And Sarah sent us an email. She says that Salvatore's tomato pie is the best pizza around. And she took a friend recently who has not found pizza that they like in Wisconsin, and they said it was the best pizza they'd ever had in Wisconsin. Also that Graft is also so good.
Oh yes, Graft is lovely too. I remember the first time we went, so it was the Graft closed for a little while during the pandemic, but then recently reopened.
Okay.
But when we first went, I remember like they have these kind of half moon booths, and they have it feels so lovely and so intimate.
Intimate, yes. Yeah. That's the word I wanted to use
it's
on that.
It's just gorgeous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's so important. We haven't really talked about the setting,
mm-hmm.
but that's all part of it. And the chefs really get into selecting the surroundings, don't they?
Yeah. And so for the chapters in the book, I really wanted to talk about how some of the spaces were laid out. So I talked to this architect named Jacob Morrison, who works here in Madison. He designed Morris Ramen.
Okay.
And he talked about how they wanted it to be kind of this jewel box, this very sort of, you know, it's close, it's intimate, yeah, but it has that Norin curtain in the front that sort of makes it feel like you're inside this little world, you're tucked inside,
mm-hmm.
which is really lovely. And talking with some of these folks about how you create the aesthetic of your restaurant, and there have been trends around this that I think make a lot of restaurants pretty loud.
Oh, I hate that.
So for a while when I was doing restaurant reviews more regularly, I literally had this little app on my phone and I would like see how loud it was.
Oh, yes. I've seen that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many decibels did we get?
I mean, right? Yeah. So it's something where you think like, okay, it feels pretty loud in here, because I really wanted to start writing about restaurants in a way that was accessibility forward. So thinking about if this place is really dark,
right,
or if this place is really loud and it's hard to hear, you know, because a lot of people, you know, my age and older or not have hearing loss or
yeah.
have mm-hmm. low hearing. So I want to think about, like, I did a story where I was going around Madison with a woman who's in a wheelchair. We're going up and down State Street, and a lot of those older buildings, you know, she couldn't get into. So writing a restaurant review that says, here's what the access is like, and including those kinds of details.
Yeah, we always tend to forget about that, but it's so important. I mean, how many times have you gone to a restaurant and used your phone flashlight to read
right.
the menu? I mean, that really doesn't make for a great experience. So,
yeah,
good things to think about. So, you know, we're getting towards the end here of time, but where do you see Madison restaurants heading? And do you think that some of the restaurants that in the rest of the state will kind of, do they follow that, or they just kind of do their own thing?
So I think that restaurants are as diverse as the people who run them. So it is difficult, if not impossible, to say, like, this is where this is where restaurants will be.
Sure.
I do think we're going to see a lot of changes that are affected by how restaurants are able to staff. So you may have already seen that some of your favorite restaurants are not open for lunch anymore, or
right.
they're not open on Sunday anymore,
yeah.
or they're only open till 8 or 9. I am a diehard late night diner. I like to eat late. Nobody's open
no.
late anymore,
mm-mm.
really.
No.
There's like a couple places, but even then, like, I used to, like, Tornado Room here downtown in Madison, they were like my go-to. There are a lot of places where I used to go for later night dining that just aren't open anymore. Or what I've also been running into is a place will say that it's open until 10 and they close at 9 because
there's nobody there.
Right.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
that's going to be something I think we'll continue to see. After the recession, we saw a lot of innovation. People were willing to try different things. And I think we might see some of that. I think we might see people taking chances in ways that we haven't seen before.
Perfect. And we do have Susie Newberling. Want to get her in really quick because she has a follow-up on the bohemian food. Susie, go
ahead. Wonderful.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just caught the tail end of your show, and I thought, what are they talking about? The entire South Side of Milwaukee is all Slavic, European, Polish, you know.
Okay.
Well, we got to go there more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Susie. Yeah, we are running out of time, but thank you for letting us know. And Lindsay, you'll have to check those out. And thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lindsay Christian is the fine arts and food writer for the Capital Times. Her book is called, where is her book here? Madison Chefs. There we go. Madison Chefs. And please go out and get it. It's awesome. You'll enjoy it. Join us tomorrow when we have Phil Pelletieri back with us to talk about insects, which we don't find in Madison Chef's food at this point, I don't think. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.